Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCane. One of the great challenges of our time is the inequality in both income and wealth. The wealth gap is large and growing. The American dream for too many people has become a nightmare of struggling around finances to pay the bills every month. Sometimes it seems inevitable that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. But a closer examination tells a different story. The rules of the game are stacked in favor of the already wealthy. Those with wealth benefit by massive subsidies and tax breaks not set in stone, but set in laws passed by Congress and state legislatures. Those laws can be changed. Moreover, the lack of resources experienced by regular people is a condition that can also be changed. There are a series of proven programs that show, with a few thousand dollars, most Americans can get an education, buy a home, or start a business, and take part in the American dream. One man has dedicated his life to finding ways to increase prosperity for all. He recently published a fabulous book describing practical, proven ways to increase economic security for every American. The book is called A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. He is here with us today to share his proven approaches to increasing prosperity for all. Robert Friedman, welcome to All Together Now.
Well, thank you very much, Eleanor.
I'm so excited you're on the air. I totally love your book. I think it's required reading for every American and certainly every person in public policy. Why did you write A Few Thousand Dollars?
Well, I thought two reasons, really. One is I was sitting on top of 40 years of experience expanding opportunity, which I thought has a lot of lessons for how we go about opening up real opportunity for everyone. It's really the American promise, right? That everyone, if everyone plays, we'll all do better.
Right.
And we have really 40 years of rigorous exploration of ways to open up the path to savings, business, education, home ownership to all that I think provide a lot of guidance going forward for community practice, public policy, private market development. I think the other reason was I wanted to share hope. I really believe that if we simply are willing to reapportion wealth building, family wealth building tax incentives that we're already spending, so that they become an investment in everyone rather than simply a windfall to the wealthy, that we could really open up the economy and import to it the untapped productive capacity of the American people. And I wanted to at least suggest how we might do that.
And you do a masterful job in it. I love the book for many reasons, but one of it is that you have this 40 years of experience of doing pilot programs and research and looking at really how, you know, what will it take to increase prosperity for more people. Talk a little bit more about what specifically you include in the book about those pilot programs and the substance of what's in the book.
So the four central chapters of the book are on savings, education, home, and business, which are kind of the paths that lead people forward economically. You know, where we're starting from is, as you mentioned in your excellent introduction, most Americans don't have a financial cushion. I mean, literally, a majority of American families faced with an unexpected $400 bill would have to resort to a lender, to a predatory lender, exacerbating the downhill spiral. I think everyone needs a nest egg of at least a few thousand dollars to buffer them from the everyday accidents and illnesses that otherwise become crises. To have a reason to imagine and think about a future better than the present, a reason to prepare and plan for that future, and ultimately the ability to invest in themselves and their kids when maybe only they believe.
Right. Well, there's a lot in what you just said there, and I love your chapters on kind of three key ways if people had more money, what they would do. Of course, kind of number one, like you say, so many people just don't even have the money to meet even a relatively small emergency. They don't have a cushion. But if they did have a little bit more money, that could bring them an education, which then leads to better jobs, better income. College graduates earn $1 million more over those who are non-college graduates on average. They could start a business, which is, an engine for ongoing prosperity for them, and they could buy a home, which is the single biggest way that most of us build wealth, is through our home ownership. So I think you've really put your finger on the button of exactly what the pathways to prosperity are. And so what do you see as the major way, given that, really we've got about half the people who can't even meet, the funds for a short-term emergency, how do we get from there to them having the funds for buying or paying for a good education, paying for a down payment on a home, or the funds to launch a small business? How do we do it?
I think the short answer is to recognize that through the tax code, both at the federal level and at the state level, we spend a lot of money incentivizing, or if you will, subsidizing wealth building by families. Things like the home mortgage interest deduction, preferential capital gains rates, pension fund exclusions, 529 college savings programs. At the federal level, we're spending in excess of $700 billion, that's with a B, dollars a year, almost as much as we're spending on defense, and more than we're spending on 14 other departments combined. But right now, that averages out to $2,200 for every man, woman, child in the country every year. But instead of investing in everybody, we are essentially rewarding the rich, missing the middle, penalizing the poor. So that the wealthiest 0.1%, this is people making over $1 million a year, get an average annual benefit from just those wealth-building tax incentives of $160,000, while working families get an average annual benefit of $226, essentially $1 for each 800 the wealthiest get. I think this makes no sense. It's not productive, and it's not fair. We are essentially investing in wealth inequality. The private sector is doing a fine job of generating wealth inequality. We do not need to subsidize it. And yet we know from self-employment microenterprise programs, from other match savings programs, for business, home, education, that given even as little as a few thousand dollars, low income, even very poor people will start businesses, buy homes, pursue college, create economic futures for themselves and their families. I think we have a prescription for a win-win-win solution here.
Say more. Like I see what you're saying, and your book is full of very specific examples of how the tax code is skewed to subsidizing wealth building for the wealthy. But I love that phrase that you talked about there, that we're rewarding the rich and missing the middle and penalizing the poor. It needs to be absolutely flipped upside down on its head. We shouldn't be aggravating wealth inequality. We should be having policies that move towards closing the wealth gap. You've got some great programs that show how we do that. Can you talk about, you're talking about this, the IDA. Explain what the IDA is and why you think it could help to close the wealth gap.
So the IDA stands for Individual Development Account. My favorite, actually, description of IDAs was from a welfare mother who said, "Oh, I see what you mean. You mean a 401k, except for us."
Right.
Again, matched savings is something I think families have been doing from time immemorial. Oh, you want that bike? Okay, why don't you mow some lawns, make some money, and I'll match, your savings, and you can buy that bike. I think we should be doing that for everybody. And again, I think we can take this piecemeal kind of investment goal by investment goal, that is savings, business, home, education, or we can wrap it all up in one kind of combined program. I think, and we have examples of that. In the book, I propose essentially a matched account for each of those, for basic savings, so that every family can have a nest egg, can get the first $500 in savings matched on a progressive basis, funded out of existing, basically savings and investment subsidies. The same for education, business, and home. And I can give, I can go more into the details of each of those. Maybe I'll just take a couple examples. In terms of education, I propose generation accounts, where every kid in the country would get up to $2,500 deposited into an account at birth, and the opportunity to earn another. This would be the poorest fifth of kids could get $2,500. It would be on a sliding scale. Every kid would be eligible, but matched at different amounts, and then would also the parents would also be matched in terms of additional savings for education or other asset building uses over the course of a lifetime. It would enable the poorest fifth of kids to acquire $50,000 by age 18. Again, we could finance it simply by returning the estate tax to where it was at the turn of the decade. I think instead of subsidizing inheritance for the lucky few, why don't we take those death taxes and convert them into lifetime opportunity accounts? We know that poor kids with a college savings account in their own name are three times more likely to attend college and four times more likely to finish college than those without, even with less than $500 in the account. So it's a matter not just of financial leverage, it's a question of psychological leverage. If kids think, and their parents think, that they're going to college, chances are they'll move heaven and earth to make that happen. What we find is that having a capital base not only helps you build financial capability, but it increases confidence, competence, and connections. People don't do things they don't think they can do, but open the door, and my experience is people do amazing things.
Yeah, so this is a fascinating idea that every child who's born gets some money put into account on a sliding scale basis, but that you talk about the conditions, there's some pretty strict conditions on accessing that. I mean, they can't just use it to buy a used car when they turn 17. Those funds are definitely oriented towards, you know, paying for an education or maybe starting a business or buying a home, things like that, right?
That's right. And again, we're talking about a public investment in the potential of common families. And I think it's right to have a quid pro quo. If you require savings as a condition of the grant, it sets up a situation where the saver feels like they earn the money. They learn about it more. And then those investments, education, business, home ownership, not only benefit the individual, they benefit the entire economy. I believe this is how economies grow.
Absolutely. And you talk in the book about various pilot programs where kind of a version of this individual development account has been tried. What's the experience so far? Where has it been tried and how effective has it been so far?
So let me take that on too. There's a lot of experience with just child accounts. There 42 states have established child savings programs starting either at birth or at in kindergarten, and in the case of communities like Oakland, have made it throughout the course. There's something called the Oakland Promise, where the whole community has come together under the leadership of the mayor and the schools to promise that every kid in Oakland will graduate from high school with the skills, resources, and expectations for success in college and career. There are future centers in the school. There are dual account programs for the poorest moms and their kids in Head Start. There's kindergarten to college that kicks in when kids enter school, and there's a robust scholarship program and mentors from the community for each kid. Oakland has bet on its future. I think the country should. So anyway, there are both programs around the country, community, local, state, of child accounts. We also conducted a rigorous national demonstration called the Saving for Education, Enterprise, and Down Payment across the country, where we even had random assignment control group experimentations in the state of Oklahoma and found out that this made a difference even in the first 3 years of a kid's development, and certainly in the attitudes and optimism of the parents. We also conducted in the 1990s the American Dream demonstration, testing whether individual development accounts could make a difference. And half of the participants, almost all of whom were low income or very poor, saved a substantial amount in that demonstration. In families living at half the poverty line, that was $9,000 for a family of four, saved about the same amount and at four times the rate of upper income folks. And they did it not because it was easy, but because it was the price of stability and the price of hope. Half of the participants in that demonstration bought homes, rehabilitated homes, went to college, started businesses, or saved for their retirement.
That's awesome. I love the stories of the people who made it and the pilot projects that have already been tried and shown that this can work. One of the things that surprised me in your book was really how little money it would take to shift out of kind of a feeling of being stuck and feeling some despair to feeling a sense of hope about the future. And you argue that people need just really a few thousand dollars to be able to have more hope for the future. How did you come to believe that it would take so little money to make such a big difference?
As in so much of my life, it was by looking back rather than forward. Started looking back at the experiments we had run in self-employment microenterprise or individual development accounts or child savings accounts, and I simply noticed that the incentives we had offered were just a few thousand dollars. I'm not saying that's necessarily enough for everybody or necessarily that it's the ideal amount, but I probably would agree with someone that would say, well, more is better, but something is essential. And again, I think there are extraordinary people, you know, who can do it without any support, and we have examples of that. But if we want to up the odds of success, then let's provide everyone with a reasonable opportunity. Again, it's not self-executing, and the magic here is not the money. I think money is a means to an end, not the end. What this nest egg, you know, and I do believe everybody deserves and in this capitalist economy needs a nest egg. But the reason they need it is to unleash the dreams and talents and work and genius of the American people. Whenever we have bet on people and that others have discarded, foster kids, they've amazed us with their ingenuity and their ability to translate a few thousand dollars into real futures for themselves and their families and their communities.
Yeah, I love the whole vision you talk about, and even, you know, some of the so-called marginal population of the foster children. I mean, my husband and I adopted a foster child, and when she was 5 years old, and the state had kind of given up on her and thought she needed to be institutionalized, and we were like, no, this child needs a safe, loving, permanent home and the right conditions in which she can thrive. And it's taken some time and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, but She's now in her 20s and a graduate of high school, and she's been a construction worker who helped to build the African American Museum and the National Mall, and now she's out doing jewelry repair. So, you know, she's thriving, and this was someone that would have cost the state upwards of $100,000 easily a year in care and treatment, who instead is a productive member of our community, of our household, and is paying taxes. So I don't think we should give up on anyone, but what we need is the right circumstances for them to thrive. And I love your vision of unleashing the dreams, the talent, and the genius of the American people. Every time we've done it, the country has moved forward. And you talk in your book about the GI Bill after World War II, and to me, that's kind of a model of this. Talk a little bit about what the GI Bill gave to the people returning from the war, and why that was such an incredible boost that led to the incredible productivity of the American economy after the war.
I would love to talk about that, but I think your story of your daughter, is it, or son?
Yes, my daughter.
Your daughter is incredible, and it reminds me of one of the other stories in the book, and as you know, I profile about 24 people who I regard as economic heroes, most of whom started with nothing, were afforded a few thousand dollars or some other kind of help, and succeeded in basically realizing the American dream. One of them, who I particularly love, is Elsie, who grew up. It was born in the Desire Public Housing Project in New Orleans. Never knew her dad. Her mom was a drug addict. They escaped an abusive non-spouse when she was 9, moved to Denver, which was the first time they ever saw snow. She said she realized that if about age 9, that if she was going to do anything in her life, she was going to have to do it for herself. She started reading books, and, you know, felt that reading was her world and school. When she got to Denver, she was taken away from her mom, and spent time in 18 foster homes, none of them really home. She got enrolled in one of the initial individual development account programs. She was doing work study. She said she didn't make very much, but she would take some money out of each paycheck, sometimes some months a few cents, some months $15. And over 2 years, she saved $1,500. And got a 2-to-1 match on that, ended up graduating from college debt-free. She said it was the first time anyone had invested in her, in cold, hard cash, and in her dreams. Today, she's a neonatal care provider, earning a near six-figure income, building the kind of family she never had.
Oh, my God, what an incredible story. I love that story.
Well, I do, too. So I have to, I mean, my other favorite story is the GI Bill. I'd love to talk about that, but I, you know, particularly given your story, I couldn't resist.
Let's get back to the GI Bill, but following this thread, because this is so powerful, I was so moved in your book about your motivation for getting into this work at all, and that you come from a family of wealth and privilege, and you tell the story of kind of an experience you had with the women on the bus. They might be women like Elsie, who were maids, and the story that then kind of was a turning point in your life that motivated you to dedicate your life to encouraging prosperity for all. Would you share that story with our listeners?
Sure. And I, you know, I am a child of privilege. My family had been very involved in Levi Strauss and Company. I'm proud of them. You know, there was never any question that I was going to go to college. Even before I was born, the day I was born, I was worth more than my dad because the money came through my mom's side of the family. It was clearly it wasn't earned or merited. When I graduated from college, I decided I needed to figure out what I was going to do with my life. I mean, partly when you are given the opportunity to do anything, then the question is, well, what matters? And I went to Atlanta to find myself. I didn't know anyone there. I'd been reading a lot of Faulkner at the time, and I didn't think that the Bay Area, where I grew up, deserved to be so smug about race relations. And I ended up getting on a bus, going from Decatur to downtown Atlanta. I had to go to the bank afterwards. And it was mid-afternoon, and the bus was filled with African-American maids in their, I don't know, 30s, 40s, 50s. I was young then. They looked old. And I must say, I was struck by how beautiful and lived in their faces were. As luck would have it, I got off the bus and was headed to the bank, as were three of the other women who lined up behind a teller, and I lined up behind them and watched as each of them took out a crumpled envelope full of change and a few stray dollar bills and presented it to the teller. So when I got to the front of the line, I said, "So what was that?" And he said, "Oh, that's our Christmas club. We're helping them save so they can buy presents for their kids for Christmas." And I said, "Oh, that's cool. What interest rate do you pay?" And he said, "Oh, no, you don't understand. We provide this as a service. We don't pay interest." And I was outraged. Why is their dollar worth less than my dollar? Why can't the financial system work for everybody rather than just for the wealthy? And I think that set me on my life course of trying to find an economic system that lives up to the American ideals and the American promise that everybody is created equal and everybody should have a chance to take their ideas to the marketplace, you know, to play and to succeed.
Awesome. I love that story. That's so moving. And it does, in a way, lead us back to the GI Bill, because when the soldiers came back after World War II, there was great fear that now that the war was over and the federal government wasn't going to be spending so much money on men and machines and weapons of war, that they would actually return to the depression that had been before the war. But up came the ingenuity of the American people with this GI Bill. Explain what the GI Bill was and how that did live up to the American ideals of creating more opportunity, if not for everyone, at least for a lot more people.
That's right. I love, in many ways, the GI Bill, although there's also a dark side to it, which I'll talk about. But the idea was very much as you've described it. I mean, partly was motivated by fear. What was going to happen when all, you know, these returning GIs came home, and would there be jobs for them? Most of the debate on the GI Bill was about how long and how much the unemployment benefits should be and last. It ended up offering, I think, $40 a month for 52 weeks. The fear was that people would just become dependent and not work. In fact, the average use of those unemployment benefits was only 18 weeks, so way underutilized. The bill also offered low-interest student loans, business loans, home loans. And those loans transformed our economy. In 10 years, they financed 220,000 businesses, 5 million homes, and 9 million college educations. In 10 years, the middle class tripled, and our income distribution went from pyramid to diamond. I really believe that what we need is a GI Bill for the 21st century, but for everyone. The thing that the GI Bill missed was it only went to male, largely male, GIs who served in the active service. It didn't go to the 19 million women who were the arsenal of democracy. It was deliberately left to state and local administrators, which in the Jim Crow South meant that African American GIs never got the benefits, by and large, that they were entitled to. Even today, you know, so many families can trace their wealth today to the GI Bill. There have been other, what I call, investments in the common genius in our history, universal public education, the Homestead Act, to which 25% of families today can attribute their wealth. The creation of the 30-year mortgage by the federal government and Ginnie Mae and Fannie Mae and those financing mechanisms, which opened home ownership to the broad middle class, all of those tended to invest largely in white males and miss women and people of color, which is a large reason why today African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, other people of color have a few cents for every dollar that whites have. Show me the assets of a child at birth, and I can pretty well predict for you the educational, occupational, income, health outcomes 50 years hence. I think this wealth inequality, which is much larger than income inequality, and much larger in its dynamics and more profound in its dynamics, I think, is the economic bedrock or the economic Grand Canyon that I think we need to overcome. But I think that simply by redeploying the wealth-building tax incentives that we already have to be fair and to be productive, we can close the racial wealth divide in a generation. We can unleash the untapped productive capacity of the American people. We can create literally millions more businesses, jobs, homes owned, educations attained.
fantastic. I love
just
that.
Just to close that. So what I would like to see, as I propose in the last chapter of the book, looking through our history, is that we essentially do a GI Bill for the 21st century based on match savings, not just on debt, because debt is so pervasive and has so, I think, grown and undermined our economic potential over the last 30, 40 years, with sliding scale savings matches for home, for business, for education, for savings, and designed in such a way that we can close the racial wealth divide.
Fantastic. So do you see, when you refer to the GI Bill for the 21st century, do you see that as kind of an umbrella term for the different types of the individual development accounts that you talk about in the book?
Yeah, I think I specifically talk about prosperity accounts. Mm-hmm. In the last chapter of the book, which is kind of an amalgam of the universal savings accounts, the generation accounts, the home accounts, and the matched business accounts, or MBAs, that I propose in the previous chapters. We can do it kind of investment by investment, or type of investment by type of investment, but the truth is that one of the magical aspects of liquid resources and asset building is that one form of asset tends to become another form.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you use your savings to get ready and to invest in college, that increases your income. Maybe you're able to save some and you can start a business or buy a house. There's a lot of economic evidence that the rise in home values in New England in the 1980s fueled then the entrepreneurial flowering in New England that followed.
Right. Well, I'm from New England and was a homeowner then, so I totally see it. When you've got ownership of a home where the value is rising dramatically, it just makes you feel more economically secure, so then you're willing to maybe go to college to get that training that you wanted, or maybe you'll take that money and start a business you might have tried, and you have that cushion, so if it doesn't work out right away, you're not going to be on the street and broke. So that rise in home value is just so helpful for those who benefit from it, which at this point is about 60% of the people have it and 40% don't. So that would be a great thing to encourage more. Not everybody should own a home, but for those who want to, it's a great asset for your ticket to the middle class.
It is. It is the major, as you correctly know, it's the major source of wealth in most families. It's been the major route. And while, today about two-thirds of Americans overall own their own homes, but that's 72.5% of white families. It's less than half of African American and Latino families. That's not because of lack of desire. 89% of Americans say they want to own their own homes. One scholar said, yes, we're a nation of homeowners and would-be homeowners. A home is so much more than a house. It's a place of safety and a place of refuge. It's a place where dreams grow and skills are communicated. I think Desmond Morris's beautiful book, Evicted, shows the power of home ownership and homelessness. I 120 years ago, only 10% of Americans owned their own homes because you had to come up with the price, the full price of the home, or at least half of it, on day one, and most Americans couldn't afford that. We opened up home ownership opportunity to the middle class with the creation of the 30-year fixed-rate self-amortizing mortgage by the federal government, but then administered, you know, with redlining and segregated housing stock so that the opportunity we afforded was not afforded equally. I think a lot of people have come to doubt that home ownership is still possible. That's certainly true in my home community of San Francisco, where housing prices and availability are very high and accessibility is quite low. But in the book, I give a couple stories of low-income people who acquired homes in the Bay Area, including David Greer, who was at one point homeless, living under the Bay Bridge. And since, with the help of an individual development account program, has bought not just one, but two homes in San Francisco, one of which he uses, he lives in with his growing family, and the other of which yields sustaining income.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, since we're on the power of home ownership, I mean, both financially and emotionally, just how vital that can be, talk a little bit about your home accounts program.
So in the federal tax code, we provide about $251 billion a year in home ownership subsidies. The best known of these, not necessarily the largest, is the home mortgage interest deduction, which is very popular. I think a lot of Americans think it's somewhere in the Constitution. It's not. In fact, it wasn't even passed as housing policy. It was part of the 1906 tax code. The idea was, well, maybe you shouldn't pay taxes on interest payments on loans. I think it's popular because more Americans get it than, or are entitled to it, than most of the other wealth-building tax incentives, so as many as a third. But you need to realize, as popular as it is, that it's really a subsidy. It doesn't help you buy a home. It's a reward for owning, or really for owing on a home. And the bigger the home, the more expensive the home, or the second home, or until last year, your yacht, the more advantage you pay. So again, the wealthiest Americans get a lot of help from it. Renters get no help from it. And in fact, you know, because renters have to pay their rent out of pre-tax income, really renters are subsidizing homeowners. And that gets a little involved, but take it. So what I recommend is,
what's the pathway for someone who doesn't own a home to have one?
I'm sorry?
What is the pathway for someone who does not yet own a home to be able to buy one?
I think we need to create the opportunity for capital appreciation for renters. And that's part of, you know, I would take that $251 billion in subsidy that we're providing for home ownership for families and redeploy it into what I call home accounts so that every American can have their savings for homes matched on a sliding scale. The first, say, $1,000 in savings each year matched from 3-1 for the poorest fifth of families to 1-3 for the highest income fifth. That would go to renters as well, and that the first $1,000 of rent can be considered that kind of savings. All of a sudden, now you have an opportunity for all Americans to begin to amass a down payment on a house, which is the biggest barrier to home ownership. There are many other barriers, and I don't think just offering a reasonable opportunity for everybody to build a home, a down payment, I don't think that will result in home ownership for everybody, but it fundamentally changes the market. And I've learned never to underestimate what people can do.
Right, absolutely. That sounds great. And one of the things that I really like about your program is that it's really a hand up and not a handout, that people can get a matching for saving, but they have to save, and then the government can match, or maybe it's a foundation or the community matches what the individual has saved. So it's a real incentive for them to do it themselves with some support. And I think precisely because of that approach, you tend to get support from conservatives as well as liberals. You know, conservatives want to unleash the entrepreneurial genius inside Americans, and they want people to work towards success. And the liberals love the idea of closing the wealth gap. And talk a little bit about the bipartisan support you've had for this approach to prosperity for all.
Yeah, I think I thank you for bringing up this point. Again, if you look at the underlying values of what I'm saying, again, hand up, not hand out, enterprise, self-reliance, savings, demanding that everybody put in their own sweat and talent, you know, I think these are values across the political spectrum. And indeed, in some of the early proposals for universal savings accounts, then called the Aspire Act, we had support from Rick Santorum and Jim DeMint, now head of the Heritage Foundation, Orrin Hatch, as well as Chuck Schumer, John Corzine, when he was there, again, across the spectrum. And I think I think it goes back to the basic ideals of this country, which I hope still are the ideals. I mean, I love them. Again, this idea that everybody is born equal, that everybody is entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which in the earlier drafts was life, liberty, and property. I like pursuit of happiness better, but I appreciate the role of property. Quotes I love best was something Abraham Lincoln said to Congress in his 1863 message. He said the primary responsibility of government was to improve the economic condition of people, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the paths of laudable pursuit for all, to afford everyone an equal start and a fair chance in the race of life. I think that's what this is.
That's exactly what this is, and I love it. How can our listeners learn more about Prosperity Now and support your efforts or try to expand them where they live?
You can find out more about Prosperity Now and our partners, many partners across the country, by going to prosperitynow.org. I hope that some of your listeners will be interested in buying and reading the book, A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for All, from your local bookstore or Amazon. My fondest hope is that kind of what I've been saying resonates with what your listeners already know. And I think we don't always talk about money. You know, some people mm-hmm. say we talk, you know, we're more reluctant to talk about money than we are about sex. But, you know, these issues of people and money and the future are important. And I think, you know, I profile 24 people in the book. I'm sure that you, well, as you've already revealed, and your listeners, no other stories like this. And again, I think this is a good news story, that that there's good reason to believe in other people in this country. Again, I think that was the fundamental bet of this nation, that we could bet on the common genius of the American people in all their diversity. And that we can make that an economic strength moving forward.
Fantastic. That's all the time we have. Robert Friedman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Eleanor, thank you so much. I really appreciated the opportunity.